Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
This week on The Wheelhouse. The 2023 legislative session. And a little later, Supreme Court decisions. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse, the show that connects the politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. Well, guys, it's officially over. Last Wednesday marked the final day of this year's legislative session in Connecticut. Since January 4th, lawmakers have been lawmaking, debating bills surrounding medical aid and dying, zoning reform, Medicaid, gun control, and so much more. We're going to break down some of the big bills from the session and also talk about what the lawmakers did not get to. And this is going to be a great conversation. Not only do I have the great Christine Stewart of CT News Junkie on the phone today. Hello, Christine. How are you this morning?
I'm well.
Good to talk to you this morning. To my left, and then right across from me, first of all, to my left, I have Jaden Edison from the Connecticut Mirror. Good morning, Jaden.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And then political reporter Susan Raff of WFSB News Channel 3. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning to you and everyone.
So happy to see Susan this morning. She's sitting directly across from me. I got Jaden to my left and the great Christine Stewart on the phone. First question goes to Christine. The final days of this year's legislative session, how did they play out? Did anything surprise you? Anything you thought would make it didn't, or vice versa? What do you think, Christine?
No, so at the end of every legislative session, we kind of do a recap, a story, like the winners and the losers of the legislative session. And
shout out to Hugh McQuaid.
There was huge consensus that Lamont was a really big winner this year, and that, you know, a lot of his priorities got over the finish line, and he was able to hold the line on the fiscal guardrails. And so during this year's budget negotiations, you know, that really forced the Democratic majority not to implement any sort of gimmicks to spend more money. And so I think that was a huge win. I think there was some, you know, and he got that done early. Look, he got, you know, the fiscal guardrails passed in February. They all agreed to this. And then when they were putting the budget together, they were kind of like, whoa, what is going on here? Like, you know, I can't fund this and I can't fund that. And so even though it looks like we have a surplus over here, there's not a lot of money to go around to a lot of these organizations who were like, hey, you know, we need help. We haven't received any help. All of our pandemic money is going away. But I mean, he also got his, you know, his gun bill over the finish line. And, you know, the only setback he had was that his Supreme Court nominee didn't make it through.
We'll get into the gun bill in a little bit. We'll also talk a little bit about some of, I guess, the losers of this session, or the people that were upset that, like Christine said, they didn't get enough money, nonprofits, higher ed. But Christine, really quickly, News 12 reporter John Craven told us last week, one half of Frankie and Johnny Craven, told us last week that it was going to be anticlimactic on the last day. What'd you think? Was that prediction, that hold up?
It was. They totally held up. John was totally right. It was very anticlimactic. I mean, the House had actually finished all of its business for the most part with an hour and 45 minutes to go until midnight. So there was a lot of some twiddling that goes on. So there was none of that electricity, got to get my bill over the finish line kind of stuff. And it was a filibuster, or, you know, an attempted filibuster most of the day of a housing bill up in the Senate. So it was kind of wah-wah.
888-720-9677, the number you want to call if you want to get on this great panel that we have. There's four of us. Maybe it's five if you give us a call, 888-720-9677. Susan, the budget, it got passed. It got passed maybe a couple of days before the session ended. So the big takeaways from this year's budget process, what were yours?
Well, I think there was a feeling that they had to get this budget done. And I agree with Christine. I think the perception was that there would be a lot more money because of the huge surplus that we have. But because of fiscal guardrails, not only this year, but also those passed in 2017, it really restricts how much money can be spent. With that said, the budget is some $51 billion 2 years. Everyone gets something. Is it what some wanted? No. And that, I don't think, is unlike many other years. So you have a lot of nonprofits. I mean, you have people working in group homes making slightly more than minimum wage, right? And so all of us would agree that they deserve more, but those have to be negotiated with their unions, et cetera. So I think that there's a lot in that budget that people are happy with. And it did get bipartisan support. And let's face it, it has the largest tax cuts in state history. And it's been such a long time since we've heard about giving money back, right? We've heard deficit after deficit and painful cuts over the years. Most agencies and nonprofits got zero or barely above zero.
As I understand it, the first income tax rate reduction since 1991, I think that's when it was implemented. Let's talk more about middle-class families, some of these low-income households that are going to be supported by this. How does the governor plan to do that?
Well, I think if you make under $50,000 a year, you'll pay no state income tax. So that's fabulous for working families who have to pay for daycare and are struggling to pay, you know, even rent at this point. And the other is for middle-class families, single, I think, up to $150 and double $300. Is it a lot of money? It's a few hundred dollars back. Is it going to solve all of your problems? Probably not. But it is nice to have some money back in your pocket, and I think that makes people feel a little bit better.
Jaden Edison, this will be one of the last times I get to say this. Connecticut, one of four states yet to implement early voting, going to change as lawmakers passed early voting legislation. Jaden, they say it's expansive as it can be with 14 days of early in-person voting.
Yeah, well, notably, the governor signed this bill yesterday, right, in a ceremony that involved a bunch of grassroots organizers and former Secretary of the State Denise Merrill and a lot of the stakeholders who've helped kind of bring this to fruition. And I think you're right, you know, particularly, you know, Connecticut has moved to implement 14 days of early voting. I know 7 for primaries and, you know, so on and so forth. And so, I mean, this is, make no mistake about it, this is a huge achievement for the state, right? I mean, you talk about, again, one of four states that hadn't implemented early voting. I think I mentioned you before, you know, I moved here from Texas, right, where we always had 2 weeks of early voting. So when I first got here, it was just so peculiar to me that this wasn't just an established thing. And so, you know, I think there is, you know, a lot of, I guess people are at least satisfied that this was able to get done in one session, right? I know there was some uncertainty around perhaps how long it would take to kind of iron out, you know, exactly, you know, there were three bills with, you know, three different, you know, day counts and things of that nature. But, you know, we're at a point now, the governor has signed this, and this is now the law of the land. And so now, The difficult part is the implementation, right, which I know around there's a lot of conversation around funding and things of that nature. But we're certainly in a historic place in terms of being able to finally get to a point to implement early voting and kind of move forward.
Well, Connecticut really is the land of steady habits. Mm-hmm. We had to have a constitutional amendment to do this. So, you know, it wasn't as if lawmakers could just, you know, go with early voting, even though a majority of the people wanted. So, and I think it had to go a couple of times, and there's certain dynamics of how much it has to pass. And so, you know, it's strange for people coming in from other states to say, well, you don't have any form of early voting. Most states do. We were one of a handful that had none.
Tennessee.
Yeah.
You know, Georgia, I believe, was one of them as well, too.
You know, the notable part, though, I mean, this has been, you know, more than a decade of grassroots efforts, right? This was something that had made, you know, the ballot at one point, you know, years ago that failed at the hands of voters who just weren't educated, perhaps, around the topic. I know that was one thing that folks had really, you know, took into consideration this time around with trying to educate folks around early voting. And so
I was wrong. It's actually New Hampshire, Alabama, yeah, and Mississippi. Go ahead.
Right.
And when you talk about the budget, what's really important with that is that given the fact that most or many cities and towns in Connecticut is 169 of them, they have part-time registrars. So they need money to roll out early voting. And there was some money in the budget, and that is something that's going to have to be addressed next year because it really isn't enough, some say, to keep this going because they have to hire more people if they're going to have voting 2 weeks before a general election.
Mm-hmm. Something like $4 million. And then just, Jaden, really quickly, how much is—oh, actually, we have Christine on the phone. Go ahead, Christine. Jump in.
No, I was just going to say that the budget really doesn't even include enough money to upgrade our voting machines, which are out of date and need to be upgraded because you can't even find parts for them anymore. They're not sold on the market. So there has to be some sort of money to actually vote.
$4 million, I think, in the budget, Jaden. And you talked to Stephanie Thomas recently. What's she saying about this? Is she okay maybe with waiting for some more money next year?
See, it's a little north of $3 million. And, you know, the interesting part, right, is in talking to her and also lawmakers, too. I think there's a general consensus and at least some sort of, I guess, comfort with knowing that there's at least one legislative session prior to the full implementation of early voting. And so I know, you know, speaking with Secretary Thomas, I know she was a little disappointed that, you know, with the lack of funding, particularly, you know, obviously around, you know, early voting. But it seems like lawmakers, you know, we heard it from the House Speaker and Majority Leader, also the Minority Leader, too. Just this general understanding that they're able to come back and come back to the table next year in February to sort of iron out, you know, a lot of the things they need to do in order to make sure that this is they can, you know, run full speed and getting this thing implemented in a smooth and efficient manner.
If you listen to the briefings Democratic leaders in the state house had in the final days of the legislative session, like I did, you'd hear Jaden Edison asking Matt Ritter, who's the Speaker of the House, and then, of course, the Majority Leader, Jason Rojas, asking them if they would codify the Voting Rights Act into law in Connecticut. Did they, Jaden?
They did. You know, this is a pretty big bill, right? I mean, well, one, let's just for clarification, right? So the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Act of Connecticut, as it's dubbed, is pretty much mirrors, you know, the landmark federal 1965 Voting Rights Act, right, which we know, you know, was monumental in protecting historically disenfranchised communities from discrimination at the ballot box. And so largely what this bill does, and it's included in the budget, right? It has a fiscal note. So it passed through the Senate. It didn't go to the House floor, but it was approved via the budget, which the governor signed recently. And yes, it codifies, you know, a lot of those same protections. Particularly, it looks at preclearance, right? You know, towns with a history of discrimination or who have certain demographics, right, will be subject to preclearance, right, which means that, you know, any changes to election-related policies, you know, will have to go through approval from, you know, the Secretary of the State or a Superior Court in their jurisdiction. It also, you know, includes protections for people who don't primarily speak English, right? So this is a very exhaustive and robust legislation that was really pushed by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And yes, it is now, it'll go into effect in July and be fully implemented by the start of next year.
888-720-9677, the number to call if you want to participate on this discussion. I'm going to ask right now our colleagues that are joining me, Jaden Edison, Susan Raff, and Christine Stewart, to tighten up those earbuds or whatever they got to do to hear this. We got a call from a friend in Madison. Arthur, go ahead. What's your question this morning? You're on the Wheelhouse.
Thanks for taking my call. I'd really like to know whatever happened to the medical aid and dying bill. I know it didn't pass. I don't know how far it went along, and if someone could enlighten me, I'd appreciate that.
Good morning, Arthur. So, thank you for calling in. It didn't go the way that some would want it. I don't know how many times, and Christine probably knows this as well, it's come up almost every legislative session. And it is a very sensitive issue, and I think some polls show that a majority of people want it. Because I interviewed a woman who was very out front about it, and she ended up passing away, and people want that choice. But there's a lot of pushback from religious organizations and also from those who are disabled, who are worried that it might be used against them in the case that someone wants to end their lives. It's a tough situation. I don't think a lot of states have it. I think it's a handful. But it is something that people feel is very sensitive and controversial in Connecticut. I'm not sure it will ever pass. Do you?
It's asking you, Christine. Susan's asking you, Christine.
Or Arthur.
So this is the second year that it made it through the Public Health Committee, and then it died in the Judiciary Committee. So while they feel like they had been made progress, it was a new legislature, so they thought they would try it out again. This bill is probably not going to come back next year unless they know they have the votes, because it's the same legislative makeup. So this is an emotional public policy issue that doesn't fall along party lines. So it's really hard unless you ask and talk to each person on those various committees exactly where they stand, whether we'll know if it has a chance of passing.
And Connecticut's law was, or the proposal was, pretty strict, right? It made it so that you would have to administer whatever that cocktail was. And so that was it.
We're going to be back. We have to take a quick break on the Wheelhouse, but we're going to talk about that housing crisis and efforts to stop exclusionary zoning in Connecticut. A lot of people not happy with how the session panned out on the affordable housing crisis.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem, or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We're talking about this year's legislative session, the big wins, the big L's, and everything in between. And I know there's a lot of people right now, Christine Stewart, that are not happy with the way the state handled the affordable housing crisis.
Yes, there are very many folks who are upset about this. The watered down legislation that they passed really doesn't do enough to encourage these towns to build high density housing for a large number of people who, you know, are generally usually discriminated against because of their race or their socioeconomic status. So we all know that nationwide there is a housing crisis, and, you know, the single family homes are not being built. And the high density housing that's needed is also not being built. So obviously, it's a supply and demand issue, so prices go up, whether you're a renter or whether you are a homeowner and trying to sell your home. I mean, your house is valued higher than when you purchased it. But I think the average right now for people who are selling their homes is 17 to 20 bids on a home, because there's only 3,000 one to four family units available for sale in Connecticut at the moment. And back in 2017, there were 17,000. So there really is an inventory issue. And obviously the inventory issue puts a lot of pressure on the cost issue and the ability to afford housing.
And what's the bigger thing here? Like, I understand there's obviously going to be a lot of people that are lawmakers in maybe Fairfield County that are happy about this. Why is this not happening? Christine, what about you? How were they not able to get this done? They wanted to do work, live, ride, which was a proposal that would have gotten more housing, or, try to help some workers get a nice place to live that's close to their job. That didn't get through. I understand there's some money in the budget for affordable housing, but nothing meaningful getting done. And a lot of lawmakers left kind of scratching their head and talking about it sort of openly in public. I don't know. What do you think, Christine? Why didn't it happen?
You know, it didn't happen. And, you know, the majority leader, Jason Rojas, admitted towards the end of the legislature, he's like, I gutted my own bill. this was my bill, and I absolutely gutted it in order to get something across the finish line, not that that something really did anything. So I think that there's a lot of lawmakers who are disappointed with this, but then there's also Connecticut is so is very much about local control. And so, you know, municipalities didn't want the state to tell them how much housing inventory they could build. And also, you know, you look at some of these other communities, and there isn't, like, more of the rural communities, there isn't the public water and sewer that's even available in order to build some of these complexes.
Ask what it would take to get something done on affordable housing and exclusionary zoning. Democratic Majority Leader in the House, Jason Rojas, said, quote, "Unfortunately, I don't know. A worse crisis? I don't know. It'll take the people of the Connecticut to demand that we do something on it." And then Matt Ritter, who's the Speaker of the House, offered, "I think employers can do something about it, too." How are you feeling about lawmakers' efforts this year? You can join the conversation, 888-720-9677. Susan Raff, we have a couple of things I want to ask you about. But first, gun legislation and some reform, maybe the most sweeping changes since we saw the shooting in 2012 in Connecticut. Excuse me, 2014. Yeah, 2012 in Connecticut, the Sandy Hook school shooting.
It is the most sweeping. And there are a number of proposals, and they were supported on a bipartisan basis. And to keep in mind, none of these bills that passed, or one big bill, take away weapons. It basically regulates them. One of the more controversial was that you could only purchase 3 weapons, guns, firearms a month. Some people think that's quite reasonable. There were people who didn't. One of the proposals that was taken out was that you had to be 21 to buy a long gun. That was definitely an issue for people in rural communities. I know Senator Kathy Austin said she couldn't support that. It also closes the loophole on some of the assault weapons. Connecticut has been a leader in gun safety laws. We haven't had really a mass shooting since Sandy Hook. And I think that's the big reason why President Biden is coming here on Friday to be part of a major gun safety summit at the University of Hartford. Biden spent quite a bit of time in Connecticut on some of the laws that had passed. And I think, by and large, people are fed up with mass shootings. And they're very concerned about what's been going on, and they want something done. Now, some would say, you know, just, are you doing something just for the sake of doing it? I think a lot of people would agree that these are regulations that will hopefully keep our communities safer.
And stay tuned to the Wheelhouse next week, as we hope to have a dispatch from Biden's appearance in Hartford. Also want to know what he's doing here in Connecticut and going to Greenwich, as I understand it. There might be a stop there.
Money. He wants money.
Money. We'll talk about that. We'll
and no one ever goes. They all go to Greenwich because they have to get
the
money.
The two capitals of Connecticut. One happens to be Greenwich. Or excuse me. One happens to be Hartford, and I spoiled it. The other one is Greenwich. 888-720-9677, the number to call if you want to talk to us. Jaden, let's talk about criminal justice.
Yep.
Criminal justice efforts this year. They also involved some efforts to have body scanners rather than these really intense pat-downs of people that are incarcerated in Connecticut, and also some efforts to change juvenile justice reform in Connecticut. What do you think? What do we see from criminal justice this session?
Yeah, very fascinating. You know, a number of bills that have been surfacing around been around the legislature the last couple of years, right? Particularly, you know, the deeming of any, you know, admission or confession inadmissible in court if it was obtained through, you know, quote, deceptive or coercive, deceptive tactics, right? And particularly that includes lying to minors, you know, in the interrogation room. And so that's one thing, you know, that got passed. In addition, you know, the broadening of parole eligibility, right, for people serving long sentences.
Yeah, let's get into that.
Yeah, essentially what this bill does particularly is for people serving long sentences for crimes they committed before turning 21, this broadens eligibility for those folks currently, or the law prior, I guess, would have been 18. And so this increases that age from 18 to 21, which was also a compromise because originally the goal was to get 25, sort of citing, you know, brain science and the maturity of young people, you know, over time. And so that's also another, you know, pretty big piece of legislation that was passed. And then also, to your point, you know, addressing, you know, youth crime, right? I know particularly what the legislature really tried to do was create more of a diversionary kind of program, pre-arrest diversion, right? So for you know, youth minors, right, who, you know, commit, you know, a minor offense such as breach of peace or a simple trespass, right? It, for the, you know, first or second time, they would go to a community diversion program versus being arrested and having to interact with the criminal legal system. And so, yeah, there are a number of bills. You know, I know a bunch of the advocates and organizers are disappointed that a lot of the efforts, which were so robust and exhaustive at the onset, had gotten watered down in the name of compromise. But, you know, there are a number of proposals that folks have been pushing for several years that eventually, you know, got through this year in some way, shape or form.
But compromise does, you know, it does a lot of things. You know, one of the things that, you know, with the juvenile crime and the crime issue that we've been having, although, you know, the pandemic, certainly we saw a lot of it. But during the gun debate conversations, Republicans were very adamant about having more consequences for repeat offenders. And that's something that a lot of people in communities. So there was compromise there. And I think that helped get those proposals over the finish line.
Yeah, Jaden, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you know, I think one of the big things you had mentioned was the body scan technology, right? And that's the key example, right, at the nucleus of this whole idea of compromise, right? At the onset, this was a very ambitious legislation to limit routine strip searches within the Department of Correction. And now, as passed, is a study on body scan technology, right? So you took something that was very robust and you know, a bunch of, you know, people had testified, gripping testimony from people, you know, who are incarcerated, formerly incarcerated, who spoke to the trauma associated, you know, with strip searches and things of that nature. And the legislature moved in the name of compromise to commission a study on body scan technology instead.
And also an effort to try to get lawmakers to, lawmakers actually had this effort to try to get police and investigators to stop with deceptive or coercive police interrogation tactics. I wish we could talk more about that, but we only got a minute left, and we're going to give it to Christine to talk about the elephant in the room. No, not the elephant in the room. The bear in the room. Go ahead. Give us something on bears here in the last 30 or 40 seconds, Christine.
Oh, boy. Bears actually boiled down to the last minute. So they did pass legislation that doesn't allow for a bear hunt, but does allow for there to be for you to take extreme action and self-defense of yourself or a loved one or livestock if a bear is attacking. And there's also some consequences in there for people who are not bear aware and who may leave birdseed out or, you know, leave a food source out unknowingly for the bears to be attracted to. So to try to counter some of these human-bear interactions.
Christine Stewart of CT News Junkie, thank you for joining us on the phone this morning. Jaden Edison, Justice Reporter, Connecticut Mirror, thank you so much for coming by and joining me to my left and across from me, Susan Raff, who I love Absolutely. To see. Thank you so much for coming here. WFSB News Channel 3.
Thank you, and good morning. I thought we had a good conversation this morning.
I thought we did. It could have been more expansive. I'm sorry we didn't get to more topics. Please listen to The Wheelhouse, 888-720-WNPR, 888-720-9677. If you want to give us a call to talk about decisions that could come from the Supreme Court of the United States. This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. June's a busy month for the Supreme Court of the United States. SCOTUS season. Over the next few weeks, the court will issue opinions on some major cases dealing with everything from affirmative action to student loan debt. And here to give us a preview, I'm excited for this conversation, here to give you a preview of what to expect is Tobias Barrington Wolf, the Jefferson Barnes Fordham Professor of Law at University of Pennsylvania's Law School. Good morning, Tobias.
Good morning, Frankie. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming on. We got a lot to sort through, and I'm really excited that you're on because I know you're going to help me get through this. Before we get into the specific cases, though, first of all, I want to tell folks that if they have a question about SCOTUS season, they can give us a call, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. Before we get into the specific cases, as I said, we got a conservative supermajority on the court right now. How do you think that's going to affect how things play out the next couple of weeks, Tobias?
Well, it really defines what's at stake in a lot of the major cases that the Supreme Court is hearing this term, including three or four of the biggest ones where we're still waiting for decisions. These are cases that are important on their own terms because of what's at stake, but they're also important because frequently litigants are taking the opportunity of this conservative supermajority on the court to ask the Supreme Court to overrule a lot of its established precedents. And so we see lawyers in front of the court having to do two things at once. They're both having to argue these important issues under the court's established precedents and also argue against efforts by their opponents to convince the court to simply overrule some of their established precedents.
There's some pretty heavy things that have come out about one of the Supreme Court justices lately based on some great reporting from ProPublica. Justice Clarence Thomas, right now, his name is in the mud a little bit here. Is that going to change anything? I'm sure there's people out there that are like, wow, the connections that that Justice Clarence Thomas has made and these trips and the allegations against him, maybe they're thinking that something can happen to him. But do you see anything kind of being altered in the next couple of weeks as a result of these allegations?
Well, I think what's most distressing about the revelations of Justice Thomas's, I think it's fair to say, really irresponsible behavior when it comes to failing to disclose financial arrangements that justices are supposed to disclose, it goes to the public's confidence in the integrity of the court and its decisions. And the justice's first job, I think, is to care about and defend the integrity of the court as an institution while they are also doing their job as justices. And we've seen a number of really distressing challenges to the court's integrity in that respect. Justice Thomas's failure to disclose these extensive financial arrangements is one. I would identify Brett Kavanaugh's behavior at his confirmation hearing as another. And so I don't think that the recent revelations about Justice Thomas are going to have any impact on how the justices are voting in the cases that are coming out. But it may contribute to some challenges when it comes to people accepting the decisions of the court as having judicial integrity. And I think that's a shame. I think it's a real institutional harm.
I want to zoom in, I guess, even more on this, because I think this is such an important conversation to have now that we're talking about public trust and confidence. There's never been, I think that a potential punishment for something that Clarence Thomas is being accused of here would be like an impeachment, but that hasn't happened before, correct?
A Supreme Court justice has never been removed from the court through impeachment. That's right. There has been a single instance of a Supreme Court justice being impeached, Justice Chase in the early 19th century. And that impeachment resulted in an acquittal or a failure by the Senate to convict. And that was an impeachment that involved a justice of the Supreme Court who was quite arguably engaged in some pretty partisan political activities from the bench. And the refusal or the decision by the Senate in that case not to remove really established a norm that impeachment of Supreme Court justices should be, at the very least, considered a last resort. And as a consequence of that, there's been a sense that the Supreme Court should be able to police itself when it comes to ethics matters. And as one point of comparison, this gets talked about a lot in conjunction with Justice Thomas, and I think properly so. In the early part of the 1970s, Justice Abe Fortas, who was a very close ally and associate of President Lyndon Johnson, wound up resigning from the court as a consequence of a combination of some political activities he was engaged in with the Johnson administration and some questionable financial arrangements that he had. And when those came to light, basically, I think the Chief Justice placed pressure on Abe Fortas and said, look, you're harming the institution of the court. It's time for you to go. And he stepped down, quite famously. And part of what Chief Justice Roberts and others have said in responding to these accusations about Justice Thomas's financial improprieties, at least improprieties when it comes to failure to disclose these extensive financial arrangements, is, you know, you can trust the court to police itself. And we have a long history of trusting the court to police itself. And that's one of the things that the public, I think, and a lot of observers of the court are now questioning a bit more actively.
We've talked about how people may accept these decisions as they come. Let's talk about the actual cases. And last week, the Supreme Court issuing a pretty big decision. We've already had one key decision here, preserving a key part of the voting rights of 1965 in Merrill v. Milligan. Can you tell us why this case is important, Tobias?
Yeah, it's a funny ruling to describe when discussing its importance, because what's important about it is that the court did not do something radical. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is this very important provision that allows challenges to electoral and voting practices that have the effect of disadvantaging voters based on race. And as a practical matter in the United States, that often means, not always, but often means practices that are disadvantaging African-American voters. And there's a very long and established body of jurisprudence that stretches back half a century or more. And in particular, the discriminatory effect idea stretches back to an important reaffirmation of that commitment by Congress in the 1980s. Very well-established doctrine. And this was a case involving Alabama and a redistricting in Alabama that was alleged to have resulted in making Black voters in Alabama have less political power than they ought to, and being targeted at disempowering Black voters in Alabama. And the lower federal courts found that this was an easy case under the court's established precedents. And in essence, what Alabama did was to come up and say, we want you to overrule your established precedents. We want you to get rid of all of these tools under the Voting Rights Act that allow challenges to redistricting of congressional districts based on this disparate impact, this discriminatory impact on Black voters. And the justices refused to overrule their earlier precedents by a narrow 5-4 vote. That was a victory for voting rights advocates, but it was a victory that just preserved the status quo. And it's, you know, it's a sign of the moment that we're in the court's history when it's a big deal and big news that the court doesn't overrule some of its earlier precedents, as was the case here.
I like that characterization, a funny ruling in that sense. And crisis, I guess, averted, because the, you know, the other concern there is the further weakening of this Voting Rights Act of 1965, because we talked about the provision struck about a decade ago that controlled which state and local governments were subject to federal clearance before changing their voting law. So, yes.
That's exactly right. And that was a decision written by Chief Justice Roberts. And for what it's worth, one difference which the chief emphasized in last week's case is that that earlier ruling was a constitutional ruling. It was a ruling that essentially said, we're no longer convinced that Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, these preclearance requirements, is necessary, and therefore no longer justified under the Constitution. And this intrusion of state sovereignty, essentially, the court held, was no longer justified. And we've, of course, seen a massive proliferation of voting suppression policies in the years since that really give the lie to that conclusion by the court. This was a case that was about statutory precedent. It was about interpreting how Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act applies and what standard it entails. And the majority rested, at least in part, its willingness to adhere to its old precedents on the idea that statutory precedent, statutory stare decisis, is stronger, because if the court gets something wrong, Congress can simply tell them that they got it wrong and fix it.
The big question here and why people care about it is, you're saying we're preserving the status quo. Is there any thought here that we could finally end racial gerrymandering with the fact that this was kind of this lawsuit from Alabama here was pushed aside? What do you think?
Well, I am hopeful that Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act will be an important tool going forward in combating these kinds of efforts to disenfranchise non-white voters. I am. Historically, Section 2 is a tool that's been used only infrequently in congressional gerrymandering cases. That's actually a point that the court emphasized in its own opinion. But now that it is one of the primary tools left under the Voting Rights Act, and now that its availability has been quite strongly reaffirmed by the court, I think that voting rights advocates are going to start making use of that tool even more actively. And I am somewhat optimistic that we will see a bit of a limitation placed on these efforts to use gerrymandering to disenfranchise Black voters.
Just a few minutes left here. I want to talk about affirmative action and why affirmative action programs at the University of North Carolina, Harvard University, why are those before the court, Tobias?
Well, this is another instance of the court being asked to revisit some of its old precedents. So for the last 45 years or thereabouts, the Supreme Court has allowed a narrow pathway for universities to take into account race as one factor among many factors that get placed into a kind of holistic review of their applicants in deciding how to craft and put together their student bodies. And that's been a very important tool in making sure that historically disenfranchised communities in the United States have some kind of pathway into higher education that is commensurate with their position in society, and that universities enjoy the benefit of a student body that reflects a broad array of perspectives, a broad array of individual histories, which has massive and important educational benefits. And the challenges to Harvard's policy under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and the challenges to UNC's policy, which is under the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution, they both present a pair of questions. One question is, are these universities adhering to the standards that the court has laid down in a series of decisions over the last 45 years, particularly a decision called Grutter versus Bollinger, which was decided 20 years ago, which reaffirmed the availability of affirmative action in higher education. And as with so much else, the other issue is whether the court should simply overrule its earlier decisions. And the court, I think, during oral argument was skeptical of adhering to its earlier decisions. It seemed eager even to overrule some of those decisions. And I am concerned that the ability of universities to use affirmative action as one tool may very well be on the chopping block.
And briefly, is there any impact in the short term on the college admissions process while this is being adjudicated?
Well, for right now, I think most universities are doing what they have been doing. That is to say, they are doing a holistic review of applicants, and the race of applicants can be one factor in that review. But it is, of course, the case that universities are preparing for the possibility of a majorly disruptive decision that would overrule a bunch of the court's earlier precedents. And if they do that, then, you know, universities will have to adhere to the law as the Supreme Court articulates it, and they will have to work that much harder to achieve fair outcomes that both mean that a broad array of students have a reasonable opportunity to gain access to competitive higher education, and also that the institutions enjoy the benefit of having a critical mass of students who bring knowledge and perspectives and a view of the world that is really necessary and important to providing a rich educational environment.
A lot left on the bone for us to talk about. Tobias, thank you so much for coming on to talk about SCOTUS. Today's show produced by Meg Dalton. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. Thanks to Tess Terrible and Katie Tularski for doing the show today. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm Frankie Graziano.